Please assume whatever position, physical, spiritual, and/or mental, that'll help you receive the good news reading today. If you've grown up like me with a lot of this, you end up with favorite passages. Guess which one is Nolan's favorite miracle? There's a lot in this one I like, but mostly it's about his mom pushing, literally pushing Jesus again into the world and the goodness she brings with that. So, John 2, 1 through 11. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to me and to you? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you to do." Now, standing there were six stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water." They filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the person in charge of the banquet." So they took it. When the person in charge tasted the water that had become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, that person called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. The word of the Lord. Junior worship time? Yeah, junior worship time. So kids can go age-appropriate time. We'll sing them out. Jesus loves me this time.
I kind of want to go outside too. She needs a coat to go outside. I don't want to go outside. Thanks, worship team, for leading us in song. Nolan, for reading that passage. I knew it was the right choice to have you read that one today. Thank you. I love it that you love it. Thanks, Lennon, for the welcome and those words from King, inspiring. And Shelley for the prayer. Thanks for all the words there, but thanks for the prayer for miracle workers, which fits in perfectly today with what we're going to talk about. I confess I have some trepidation coming in today because I have to say the word miracle multiple times. And as Debbie Curtis has pointed out, I never say it correctly. And my companion, Matt Caldwell, who said, "Don't listen to her. Just say it how you say it every time." He's not here today, so I don't have his voice. So now I'm going to stumble over it the whole time. It is quite a thing when you go 4+ decades saying a word one way with never knowing everyone who hears you talking saying, "What did he just say? Does he mean miracle?" Which I think is how you say it. I don't know. It doesn't matter. Anyway, here we are. We're going to talk about miracle workers today. Thank you. Yes, all are welcome, however they say this. Jesus did this. The first of his signs at a wedding in Cana in Galilee. I wonder, as Nolan read that passage, did you notice anything strange about John 2 today? Anything peculiar stand out for you? For example, did you notice after Nolan sort of led you into it, did you notice the passage keeps calling Mary the mother of Jesus? The gospel never once says her name, Mary. I mean, all the other gospels do, but in John, we get the mother of Jesus. She is literally the most famous woman in the Christian world. Everybody knows her name. Why doesn't John use it? It's peculiar, right? And speaking of the mother of Jesus, how about the rich dialogue with her son? And I'm not sure rich is the right word, because is it just me, or does it feel like a part is missing from it? The entire conversation consists of two sentences. Nothing is resolved in those sentences, except, apparently, everything is. It's just weird how John has written it. And speaking of those two sentences, I am sure you could not have missed this. Did you notice how Jesus responded to his mother? He addresses her not as mother or mama or mom or even ma'am, but as, Noland, woman. I can tell you with absolute certainty, I would never refer to my mom as woman in that way. Now, apart from our gospel reader today, who clearly loves Jesus when he says stuff like this, who does that? And it's not that the term woman is disrespectful in their setting. It's just odd and unheard of in their world. Not a single historical document that we have references anyone ever referring to their mother as woman, except that is for the Gospel of John. Again, it's just strange how John tells the story. But then it gets even more odd. Jesus follows up with this. What is this concern of yours to me? It's as if Jesus is chuffed that she's even brought it up in the first place. So the wedding's going to be ruined. Big whoop, woman. But that's just it. In his culture, it was a big whoop. In Jesus' world, weddings were a seven-day affair, as we've discussed before. I just sometimes imagine paying for that. Seven-day affair. And according to John's timeline, we're only on day three when the wine begins to run low in Cana. To put that in perspective, and I'm so delighted that you guys are here today. To put that in perspective, imagine, for example, we're at Carolyn and Miles' upcoming wedding. And right in the middle of the reception, Carolyn's aunt Jen turns to Carolyn's uncle Noland and says, only half the guests have made it through the line and the food's already run out. And then imagine Noland saying in reply, woman? It makes me smile thinking of him trying to get away with that. Oh. Woman, why should I care? He says. To which Jen replies, because she's your sister's kid whom you love since she was born. What do you mean, why should I care? And the same comment, why should I care, from Jesus made no more sense in his time than it would at Carolyn and Miles' wedding. Again, it's just, the whole thing is just odd. And there's more. For example, the fact that apparently Jesus does care, even though he's just said he doesn't, and ends up making not simply what was needed for that wedding, but an abundance of what was needed for that wedding. Some 150 gallons of wine for that party. Do you realize how much wine 150 gallons is? Given that an estimated wedding attendance in a small town like Cana would be somewhere around 100, and given that 150 gallons is equivalent to nearly 1,000 bottles of wine, that means that Jesus made 10 full bottles of wine for each and every single guest at the wedding. Carolyn and Miles' reception just got a lot more interesting. 10 bottles of wine. Oh, and then the way he goes about producing the miracle itself is intriguing. Asking the servants to fill 6 25-gallon stone jars with water, because where in the world would they have gotten all that? They couldn't simply turn on a spigot. How far did those servants have to travel and carry 150 gallons of water, which, for the record, I looked it up this week, would weigh in at just under 1,250 pounds. How long must that have taken? If Jesus can make wine Can't he make the water to make the wine out of in the first place? Why send the servants off to get all this? And then, of course, there is just the strange juxtaposition of the secrecy and the revelation in John's story. No one knows he did it apart from his mom and the servants, and yet somehow it reveals his glory, John says, and inspires belief and trust from the disciples. It's just curious, right? The point being, this story, as John narrates it, is more than a bit peculiar, which raises the obvious question, why? What is going on here? What are we meant to make of all of this? Well, I think the answer, at least in part, is this. Throughout John's gospel, we find a very similar pattern repeated over and over. John offers every time the barest of details and then encourages the reader to ask, given all that he's excluded from the story, what's so significant about what he has included? It's kind of like with John reading and interpreting a poem. And when we do that, attend to what he has in fact included, given all that he's excluded, there is something rather significant that remains in John 2. But just what is that? Well, in John's inimitable and peculiar way, what he has left us with in these 11 verses, and that's all we get, what he has left us with may in fact be the most surprising details of all of those ones I've just listed for you. Traditionally, we have considered this a story about, of course, Jesus. And for good reason. Jesus performs a miracle every alchemist has dreamed of. The manipulation of matter from one substance to another. So we are right to say, of course, that this is a story about Jesus. And yet, there is also this, the unavoidable fact that in one of the single most famous Jesus stories of all time, John has managed, in the span of just 11 verses, to offer details about not one, but five. Did you notice that? Five wholly different and wholly unique characters. Jesus, of course, makes his appearance, but he is hardly the only, and perhaps not even the most memorable person in today's passage. And that, after all that John has left out, tells me that it is something significant that we are meant to attend to. Consider, we meet, of course, Mary. Mary is part of the story. Mary, who stands out so starkly precisely because she's not even named, as if the whole point in not naming her for John is to ensure that we do not miss her. You know, sort of like the reverse psychology, I'm not going to name her, now you're going to think about her, that type of thing. Mary, who, by the way, is the very first person John even mentions in the passage. There was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Before Jesus and his disciples even enter the scene, Mary is mentioned. Why? And Mary, of course, is not alone. John also takes time to note a group of unnamed servants, of course. The ones who are somehow able not only to find 150 gallons of water, who knows where, but also to find the means, who knows how, and the time, who knows when, to transport it all back to those six 25-gallon jugs. And the question is, why even mention those servants? We can easily imagine a version of this story where those servants make no appearance. In fact, in most summaries of John 2, they're excluded entirely. So, why does John make a point to mention them, given all that he's left out? Why? And then, yet another persona in our story, we meet, of course, the person in charge of the festivities, the wedding steward, as we have traditionally called them, the one who first tastes the new wine and then joyfully proclaims how extraordinary it is, both to the bridegroom and presumably to everyone in attendance, in celebration of this uncommon gift they have all just received. And once more, we have to wonder, given all the details he excludes, is this just some colorful detail he's thrown in for no reason? Or is this person significant in some way? And then finally, of course, the disciples. And I use that word finally advisedly, because just as the story begins with someone other than Jesus, this story also ends with someone other than him too, which in biblical narratives, as in all ancient Greek literature, is a big deal, who the story begins and ends with. And it raises the question for us once again, why? Why highlight the disciples by ending the whole story with them? All of which is to say, why? After cutting out so many details that the story just becomes bizarre, why does John go to so much trouble to describe not only Jesus, but these other four characters as well? And I suspect the answer is something like this. Here, in the very first miracle story of Jesus' ministry, John is trying to teach us what miracle making really means. Of course, because it's John, he is coy about it, alluring us with the lack of details to draw us further in. And what his storytelling style seems to suggest, by juxtaposing miracle with so many characters, is, I think, unavoidable. Namely, and simply, and perhaps even profoundly, that miracle making is never done alone. The performance of this miracle at every turn seems to depend upon all five of the characters John describes, without whom there actually is no miracle at all. Or, to put it more starkly, John seems to be saying in his storytelling this morning that Christ is able to do God's miracle-making work only when God's people partner with him. Which is to say, sometimes for miracles to occur, we need a Mary among us. Someone who attends to and who names the empty and dry places in our world. They have no wine, she says to her son. And that simple observation becomes the very place from which miracle begins. It is the equivalent of, look, they have no food, no justice, no security. We have no vision, no direction, no hope. Lord, they have no home, no help, no safety. They have no wine. Mary notices and names the empty and dry places of the world and thereby calls for a miracle to be born. Without Mary, no one notices, and there is no miracle. And then, turning to the servant, she simply declares, do what he says. Which is to say that sometimes, for a miracle to occur, we need humble servants among us who do the hard and never-ending work of bringing water, the water of kindness and goodness and gentleness and love, without which there can be no wine, the gentle touch that becomes a source of comfort, the loving gesture that becomes a source of encouragement, the kind word that becomes a source of hope, the water that becomes the source of wine. Without the humble servants, there is no water, and therefore no miracle. And sometimes for miracles to become all they are meant to be, we need what John calls the steward, the one who receives the wine and immediately declares, "This is good," and with unabashed delight invites everyone in the room to come and taste and see. Imagine here the June Brennigers of the world, who always seem to notice the gift of good wine all around them, so to speak. The good, the true, the beautiful, and who not only gratefully acknowledge it, but joyfully distribute it to everyone she comes in contact with, passing around 10 bottles each, so to speak, so that the miracle might widen and continue to bless. Without the steward, the miracle simply cannot become what it is meant to be. And then sometimes we need disciples who, like John himself, proclaim far and wide the glory not only of the miracle, but of the miracle maker himself. Recognizing we are not here simply to give and receive wine, as important and essential as that may be, but we are also here to give and receive the one who made the wine in the first place. For what good is a passing gift if we've missed our relationship with the very gift giver, which is perhaps the most important miracle of all? Which is all simply to say that according to John, there are in this world no miracles without you, the Marys among us, who notice and name the dry places for us, the servants among us, who do the difficult and daily work of faith, the stewards among us, who proclaim and share the good wine when it arrives, and the disciples among us, who proclaim and share the good news. Why does John leave out so much in this miracle story, but include all those details about other people? Because he wants to remind us we are all in the miracle-making business together. I may never be able to do what Jesus did, but I can certainly find my place among those others. So, come, let us be about the work of making miracles, so that in partnership with our God, we might in fact come to bless and heal this world, one bottle of wine at a time. Amen.